Okay, well, thank you. I'd like to tell you about recent results we've got with this DTS experiment. And they have to do with the mean flow in this experiment and fluctuations in what turns out to be some kind of modified telostate MHD flow, and I tried to show that. This is work of the Geodynamo team in Grenoble, and you see the names coming in the presentation. The outline of the talk is, well, first a few words about our setup, but many of you already know, I think. Then, okay, sorry. Better? Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe. Okay. No. Can try the other side. Huh? Okay. Change in, see? Yeah? Ah, yeah, okay. Better. Okay, then a few words about superrotation, which we've recently observed in our experiments. Then I focus on two aspects, the mean flow, in which I will introduce this modified telostate model, which is a useful guide for what we find, and fluctuations, which take the form of wave in our case, and conclusions. So first on the setup, the DTS experiment is one of these few experiments in which we use liquid sodium, 50 liters. You know Turkish culture, it's Derviş Turna sodium, so I tried to do it. Let's see. Derviş Turna sodium is the name for the... Okay? You figure out why in the coming thing. So 50 liters of liquid sodium inside a stainless steel sphere, of outer radius 21 centimeters, so it's something like this. This sphere can rotate around the vertical axis up to frequencies of about 15 hertz, and inside is a small inner sphere, which also can rotate at a different velocity around the same axis at up to 30 hertz, which makes a differential rotation up to 45 hertz if we rotate contra-rotation. This is how it looks like in the lab, stainless steel everywhere, a tank, and so on. I won't say much more about the setup, except to point out that this DTS stands basically for rotating spherical quet flow, because we have this rotation between an inner and outer sphere. The overall thing can be rotating. And the peculiarity of this experiment is that we also impose a strong dipolar magnetic field. That's because inside the inner sphere, we have a strong magnet, which produces a field of about 170 millitesla here, 1.7 kilogauss for astronomers here at the outer region of the inner sphere, down to 8 millitesla at the outer boundary. And this has been chosen so as to explore the magnetostrophic regime, in which we think that there are comparable sizes for the Lorentz and Coriolis force as given by the Althusser number. You'll find more details in these articles about the setup. Okay, the DTS experiment is not a dynamo, but the flow modifies the magnetic field. We have a magnetic resonance number up to about 40 in the maximum case. And moreover, the magnetic field modifies the flow very strongly. We have an interaction parameter of the order of 10. It's larger than near the inner sphere. Global rotation can be present. And I also will show that in this geometry, numerical modeling is tractable and, in fact, a very useful guide for understanding what is going on. Okay, I start by showing you some measurements of the flow velocity inside our liquid sodium. So this is, again, a close-up of the sphere with the inner sphere here, which has the magnet. And we use this ultrasonic Doppler velocimetry technique to get measurements of the flow velocity inside the sphere. So here's an example where we shoot from one of these assemblies here with a small Doppler transducer, a beam of ultrasounds. And we listen to echoes coming from various points on this beam. And we retrieve the Doppler shift of these echoes and therefore get a profile of the velocity along this profile, of, along this line, along the projection of the velocity along the line of sight. And you'll find more about this method and how it works in this article. I will illustrate what we get in one first case where we observe the so-called superrotation, and that's when the outer sphere is at rest. So we're only spinning the inner sphere. This is a numerical model performed by Dominique Jo of axisymmetric nonlinear model of what happens in that case. The outer sphere is at rest, F equals zero there, and we rotate only the inner sphere. And what you're looking at here are the output of numerical model in terms of the angular velocity contours here inside the fluid for parameters which are not very far from the ones we get experimentally. Fairly high Reynolds number, a magnetic Prandtl number, which is the one of liquid sodium. And what you observe is something which had been predicted from numerical modeling of Emmanuel Dormy before that, is that you get this flow velocity pretty much aligned with the magnetic field according to Ferraro isorotation law. And you get this region here in red where the velocity, the angular velocity of the fluid is actually larger than that of the driving inner sphere. We'll look later at the profile of this Doppler velocimetry technique in the experiment, which is projected here in this meridional plane for which we had the computation. So you'll be looking at the velocity acquired along this line. And this is what we obtained recently in the campaign about 1 month and a half ago. If we look at this profile, so that's from the first entry point of the outer sphere all the way on the other side of the outer sphere. And we get these three, I've selected three profiles here. Again, the outer sphere is at rest. And this is for delta F of a few hertz. We get this velocity in terms of, well, frequency of the fluid, if you want. The angular velocity given as the frequency of the fluid divided by the frequency of the inner sphere. Everything which is above this one line is superrotation. So the fluid is actually in superrotation for large volume in the sphere, rising from velocities here near the outer sphere gently to this superrotation region. And the comparison with the model I just showed, which had these parameters, is pretty convincing that they have something to do together. Even though in the experiment, the Reynolds number is about two orders of magnitude larger, this does not kill the superrotation. Okay, I now shift to what we understand better now for this mean flow in the case of global rotation. This was without global rotation. The outer sphere was at rest. Now I go to the case where there is global rotation. And we, again, we'll be using one of these nice axisymmetric nonlinear models of Dominique, which is now for the case where the actual parameters of the experiment, so the same magnitude Prandtl numbers, the same imposed dipole of field, and we have rotation of the outer sphere of 5 hertz now. And in this numerical computation, the rotation of the inner sphere is 0.4 in excess of the global rotation. It's much smaller than what we do in the experiment normally, but it's tractable numerically, even though, again, the parameters here, which are the real ones of the computations, are pretty impressive already. The big difference with the previous case is that you still have this region of Ferraro-type rotation with the inner sphere, but you see that we rapidly move to a region where the flow is really geostrophic, aligned with the rotation axis, not anymore with the magnetic field. And this happens, basically, this transition, when the local excessor number gets around 1. So it's not really a surprise, but still it's amazing that we have such a strong constraint of rotation, even though the magnetic field is still very strong here and is still playing a strong role, as we'll see. Okay, the region of superrotation is shaded, it's here. It's much closer to the inner sphere, and superrotation is also much smaller. That's clearly seen on, if we take a profile of the azimuthal velocity, angular velocity, along the equator here. This is the profile here is 1, so the rotation of the inner sphere, and this is from the edge of the inner sphere to the outer sphere here. So we see that the angular velocity has a small superrotation in that region close to the inner sphere. But then there is a plateau where, in fact, there is almost no shear, almost solid body rotation, and then a gentle down to zero velocity at the equator. This is not quite a surprise, because if we think of Taylor demonstration dating back to 1963, he pointed out that in a case where you have geostrophic, the magnetic torque which applies on tubes or cylinders aligned around the rotation axis at some cylindrical distance S can be expressed as Pat said we should have at least one equation, so I put that one. I have another one. This is just the expression of the magnetic torque applied on this cylindrical or tube of liquid. And it's proportional to this term here, the integral over B of BS, which is the S component of the enclosed magnetic field, times B phi, which is the phi azimuthal component of the induced magnetic field. And of course, Taylor pointed out that there was no torque to balance this magnetic torque, and therefore that this integral had to be zero in the geostrophic case when the Reynolds number, Rossby number, all these numbers are small, and Ekman number is zero. And you see that, and of course B phi in our case, since we impose the dipole magnetic field, B phi, another equation, is simply resulting from this term in the equation. This is the diffusion term for B phi, and the only production term is basically the shearing of the imposed magnetic field, BF. So that in order to have this torque zero, the simplest solution is to have B phi zero, which means having no variation of F with frequency altogether, which of course gives you solid body rotation at the speed of the inner sphere, which is not so far from what we have. But Clarin in 1997 tried to go a bit further, in particular after the numerical results of Rainer Hollerbach, and they pointed out that in more real configuration with the finite Ekman number, not zero, this magnetic torque could be balanced by friction in the Ekman layers at top and bottom. And you can actually include this Ekman friction and compute it in the laminar case, and that's what they've done. And they come up using a smart way of estimating what the B phi component should be with this prediction here, this profile in red, which explains fairly well the actual numerical model. So in here, basically, what it says is that we are allowed now to have some shear in that region as opposed to what we have in solid body rotation, because we need, in fact, some B phi to counterbalance the friction in the two Ekman layers at the top and bottom. Okay, so I said I would talk about experiments, so let's still look at some actual profiles. This is a collection of velocity profiles measured along this beam for a case when the sphere is rotating for different delta F, 3.26, a few hertz. And they are all being kind of put together, and they have very similar profiles. These are these different profiles here. This is the outer sphere here. Sorry, I had to shift the thing. Outer sphere down to, to the close to the inner sphere here. And this is, again, this numerical profile of Dominique projected along the line of sight, so synthetic from this model, and Clarin's prediction, this dotted line. And what we see is that our profiles behave rather similarly, except that they have a much more gentle rise here. And that's fairly well taken into account if we think that in the experiment, the Ekman layer, even though they are very thin, of order millimeter, become turbulent themselves. And we can take into account the enhanced friction in this Ekman layer, put it in the model, and derive this type of behavior here, which is fairly good agreement with the actual experiment. So again here, fairly simple and explainable behavior, even though the Reynolds number is of the order of a hundred thousand. Okay, so we think we understand fairly well now the mean flow, and I spent some time on it because it's really what controls, what's the dominant part of the flow. To convince you of that, I'm showing here again one of these profiles, except that this time it's not just the average velocity, it's the actual distribution of velocities if we measure like for 1,000 seconds or so, 100 seconds or so, for many, many of the time. You see that there is very little fluctuation around the mean flow, except in that region near the inner sphere where we don't know if it's actual or instrumental. So very little fluctuations, even though we can directly compute from this velocity measured here of 1 meter per second or so, a magnetic Reynolds number of about 3 and the kinetic Reynolds number of about 400,000. When there are fluctuations, they have a very specific shape, waves basically, and I will go quickly in showing you, this is last part, the examples of these waves that we record. We are using for that some measurements of electric potential at the surface of the sphere. There is a magnetic field, the flow, so there are electric currents and electric potentials. We can measure these, and we can measure these at different longitudes and therefore see if there is some wave going by. And in fact, when we look at the spectrum as a function of time of this electrical signal, so this is frequency along this axis, 0, 50 hertz. In France, the current is 50 hertz. And this is for a half an hour sequence in which we've been varying. So the outer sphere is at rest, but we are varying the frequency, the rotation of the inner sphere in various steps. And you see this line which gives you this, so up to about 25 hertz or so. And you see that the spectrum is really dominated by this kind of band, broadband, which in fact correspond, when we look at the correlation, to waves with different azimuthal wave number. You see here 2, 3, 4, 5, we've labeled them F. You also see a much thinner line here, N3, which is also an M equals 3 mode, but of different nature, obviously. This is even more spectacular when we look at the spectrum of the magnetic field, which are not like the ones we've seen in the two previous experiments, but we really find a spectrum with these peaks, which correspond to these different wave numbers. These are, of course, spectra as frequency, as a function of frequency, not K, not the wave number directly. Okay, just showing you now for the rotating outer sphere, what happens. Again, one of these sequence, 800 seconds, spectrum in this direction, but this time the sphere is rotating at about 5 hertz or so. And you can see a little signal here at 5 hertz corresponding to that. And again, we've been changing the velocity of the inner sphere, which is counter-rotating in this case. This is minus 5 hertz here, minus 10, minus 20. And the first thing you see is that there is nothing to see in these small velocities. Basically, again, the answer is that there is no fluctuation at all in this flow, even though we have very large, in principle, Reynolds numbers. And then you see appearing some other types of waves, again, now with a wave number of 1, 2, and 3, which behave differently. I mean, they do not go with the delta F frequency as before. And you can see more details on this in a paper which is appearing in GFN. We could measure the dispersion curve for this mode. So this is as a function of the azimuthal number here, 0, 2, 4, 6. For these various types of waves we've observed, the frequency of the mode over the frequency of the fluid in the reference frame rotating with the fluid. And we find rather well-defined dispersion curves, which show us that these waves are some kind of magneto-inertial waves. They cannot be, at least from this dispersion relationship, this part, for example, cannot be a simple inertial mode because it'd be too high frequency for that. But they are, of course, very reminiscent of what Kelly and Al have found in a rather similar type geometry experiment, and Dan will tell us much more about that in a few minutes, which have been shown to be very similar, well, identical to inertial modes in the sphere in that case. They have much lower frequencies than we get for the experiment. So this part on the waves, we have no real explanation yet of what these modes are. We observe them, we document them, we're trying to combine now the various methods to better understand them. But they, and we don't know what they are, but they certainly dominate the spectra. So to conclude, while we've observed, finally, I would say, this very large superrotation when the outer sphere is at rest, even though the Reynolds number are very large, concerning the mean flow when the outer sphere is rotating, we have this quasi-geostrophic domain, each time the Essasson number, local Essasson number is less than 1, which is very interesting because Coriolis there dictates the geometry for sure, but the driving is all by the Lorentz forces. A modified Taylor state is a very good guide for explaining what happens with this magnetic torque which balances friction with the Ekman layers, and it actually explains well the experimental data when turbulent layers are considered. Fluctuations dominated by non-axisymmetric waves or modes. We found the dispersion relationships that are not compatible with simple inertial modes, and that's a challenge, I think, for numericists to try to compute these modes in this rather complex geometry, and we are working on that with Denis Schmidt in particular. When the outer sphere is not rotating, we have almost no fluctuation, even when the Rossby number is positive, at least, because the combined constraints of rotation and magnetic field kill turbulence altogether. So on some speculations from this work on what could happen in the Earth core, I've noted here that for a prescribed magnetic field, what we find is that because of rotation, the flow has no freedom to fluctuate. But of course, the magnetic field can fluctuate. It's high Reynolds number, magnetic Reynolds number, so that it can fluctuate only because the flow is making it fluctuate. And for the density field, which is absent from our experiments, there is no density convection or whatever, it can fluctuate, but also only under the action of the flow. And That can drive us some conclusion. Okay, I stop here, and to foster the discussion, Mr. Chairman, I've listed a few quite believable beliefs which turn out to be wrong in our experiment in DTS, just to foster some more questions.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
You fitted one of the profiles by assuming that the Ekman layer is turbulent. The assumption presumably was the Ekman layer is turbulent and the rest is not.
Yeah.
And could you explain a little bit what went into the assumption? How did you get the profile from assuming that the Ekman layer is turbulent? Did you simply put a different viscosity, or what has been done?
Yeah. Okay. I can maybe show it here. What you're saying is that to model this profile, we kind of take into account what happens in this very thin Ekman layer when it becomes turbulent. We've taken some friction laws, which were derived by, I can't remember the name now, I find it the reference. There are some numerical models on when these Ekman layers become turbulent, and we can retrieve from that the friction velocity corresponding to that. And this is the input then of this Ekman friction that we compute at the boundary, which replaces the classical laminar Ekman friction. And just on the point you said, we can see that even on this profile, this Ekman layer is so thin that we miss it with the velocity profiles. It's not there. But we know that it can't be more than a few, that 1 centimeter maybe altogether.
I was thinking about your spectrogram and about this PDF plot. The wave propagation speed, one would certainly expect to be related to the rotation rate of the fluid locally where the wave propagates. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you sort of have two or three layers here for bulk rotation rate, and I wonder if you have any thoughts about which of those layers support which of your wave modes, and if you could simplify things by thinking along those lines.
Okay, well, some elements, but no definite answer. Well, for one thing, when I said that we had looked at the frequency of the modes in the fluid reference frame, that means we've taken this part because we had this kind of solid body rotation. But of course, you're right. I mean, it does depend on S. And now I have just one small maybe part. No, they are in. They were for the electric potentials. They are embarked on the sphere, so they are in the rotation sphere. But then we have one example of, well, no, more example, but here I have one example. If we measure directly the radial velocity profiles in the liquid sodium and make also spectra, we can retrieve again this frequency band. So this is now frequency along this axis, 70 hertz, and this is the outer sphere, and we touch here the inner sphere. And we see that these waves we observe at the surface are really affecting the wall depths of the fluid, basically. At least for that case, we have not been able yet to come up with a complete image of how they are organized, both at depth and at the surface.
With such well-defined equilibrium velocity profiles, it's nice and smooth and relatively laminar. Mm-hmm. Where is the difficulty in computing the wave eigenmodes in the system? I'm just a little bit surprised that you mm-hmm. can't immediately give us the linear modes of the system.
Well, it's not so simple because we have several ingredients. I mean, we have the global rotation, and that would give us inertial modes. It's okay, fine. But we have this differential rotation, which is rather strong. So we don't have a simple, well, compared to what Doug Keller had, for example, with Andreas, they could compute the modes for not taking into account the global, the differential rotation at all, just the modes of the spherical sphere at a given rotation rate. It's much more, won't work in our case. And third, you have the magnetic field, so you have an alpha waves, and in fact, we think that some of these waves are affected by that. But at the current moment, Denis Schmidt is actually computing these modes with all these different ingredients. I don't think that it's been done anywhere else, as far as I know.
So it's just a matter of implementing the eigenfunction solver, I guess, rather than applying a theory which is applicable for uniform rotation.
Well, at least, yeah, it should be, well, one difficulty is that we are starting from a basic state which already has differential rotation and even possibly some induced magnetic field in it. But yeah, at least for the small differential rotations, we should be able to do that more.
Related question, you talked about magneto-inertial waves. Mm-hmm. Is it possible you have magneto-Rossby waves in there? And would you be able to detect them?
Well, in fact, we were expecting Rossby waves to begin with. They probably are playing a role, but it's difficult to know. I'd be interested in any recipe to try to separate all these modes more efficiently. I just don't know very well how to do it.
Dan, then Pat, and then we'll go to break.
So your list of different conclusions included one where the large magnetic field did not necessarily lead to large induced fields. But I imagine that there are large induced toroidal magnetic fields near your inner sphere, in part that are driving the superrotation. Could those toroidal magnetic fields have alphane waves that are some of the modes you see?
Well, one of the surprises which came out of this numerical model, which is not quite in the proper exact range, but still, was that the predicted toroidal magnetic field, azimuthal magnetic field, was not really what we expected it. And this slide here. This is again this model of Dominique with the French rotation. And these are contours of the induced azimuthal magnetic field. And clearly the maximum is somewhere around here, which is where, in fact, the shear is maximum. So that's where you can create some strong magnetic field. But there where you have an enormous poloidal field to play with, the flow is unable to change it, to deform it, and you have very small magnetic equivalence number there, magnetic fields induced there. That's why I was putting this kind of statement. We have not yet measured this magnetic field directly in the experiment, and we should do that in September by having something going inside the fluid. So far, we've avoided that. But it would be interesting to see if actually this strong magnetic, well, this magnetic field is observed there. Still, this induced magnetic field is smaller, much smaller than the one we have here for the dipolar part. So we expect alpha waves to rather develop on that field than on the toroidal field there.
But from the peak B phi and its radius, the value of B phi and its radius, you can immediately compute the frequencies of the different modes at that peak.
Well, not really, because this just comes on top of the imposed dipole field. So the alpha waves kind of follow the field lines, which are much more complex than just that.
Okay. I mean, you correctly question the simplistic ideas of turbulence with a naive use of the parameters. But I mean, in some sense, it's not at all surprising because you have such severe constraints with rotation and magnetic field. So what is happening is you're converting the turbulence to what might be called wave turbulence. So then the two questions are, you could characterize the extent of, to what degree it's really wave turbulence by the ratio of the line widths to the frequencies for a given eigenmode. In other words, that should be small in some sense if it's a line width at fixed mode numbers to frequency. That should be small in a wave turbulence dominated state. And I guess the second question, though, is what kind of, do you see any sign of secondary flows? Because one could imagine the inertial waves in particular driving secondary flows. Through beat interactions and so forth.
Okay, on the first point, yeah, we probably have to do something like that. It's a bit difficult because we haven't got, of course, this is an experiment, so we can't measure things everywhere. But we have these very nice spectral lines I showed for the magnetic field, for example. They are not very thin because, yeah, there is some dispersion. Especially when they are strong. We're not completely surprised that the turbulence was kind of damaged by this presence of both rotation and magnetic field. But at the same time, it's a bit what we... Constrained, okay. But at the same time, it's certainly a situation which prevails in many planets or celestial objects, so it's good to think about it. And then on the second point, all I can say so far is that when we measure radial velocity in the experiment that we've done that, we get profiles which certainly have a bit more structure than in the simple numerical computation I showed with small Reynolds number. So basically, we have some recirculation in the radial direction going on. What would... Yeah, but we have such a strong zonal flow to begin with that I don't know. But okay, we took. Okay, yeah, talk more about that then.
We have to slow down just a little bit. The caterer is not quite ready, so we have 1, 2, maybe 3 minutes to kill. So we can have a discussion here.
No. I wanted to ask a question, so I'm glad I can. Yes. So, Henri Claude. So tell me, what is it about the super rotation that you seems to be looking for in this simulation? Do you think there is such a thing in the Earth core?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible that the inner core be rotating at slightly faster or slower than the rest of the core. I mean, there's been this discussion in the geodynamics community. It's not doing it by itself. It's under the action of what happens in the core anyway. So, although in some cases you could have some gravitational coupling, for example, which has a different origins and directly the action in the core. But no, I can't think of any actual direct application to what happens in the core. It's just a nice physical problem. Might have to do with the super rotation in the atmosphere of the sun, rather. I don't know.
Yep.
Your success with measuring velocities of liquid sodium. Mm. Do you have any plans to share? Can this technique be applied in other experiments? Do you plan to share?
Of course we're ready to share. Now we actually already have worked, for example, with the VKS team on this topic. Our situation is rather favorable because velocities, as you've seen, are very well constrained. So, for example, we can even play... First of all, for this to work, you need a guru. So Daniel Brito, who's here, is our Doppler guru. When he's not here, the experiment, we never get velocities. So you need that. When you have that, you have a good instrument. There are still some problems which are not very clear on why the wave gets through. Sometimes it gets stuck, we get no signal. It has to do with the kind of wetting of the liquid sodium with the transducer. Dan has been also actively working on this, and he's measured some velocities in liquid sodium. In our case, yeah, we have these very well-behaved velocities. And so, for example, we can even play to have some aliasing. That is, there is a limitation in this Doppler measurement that if you get too large velocities, it's kind of folded back in some lower velocities. But since our profiles are very well behaved, we can actually play with that, and that's the way we obtain this super rotation, very long profiles all the way through. They were actually kind of double the frequency. I don't know if it's clear, but... And so, yeah, it can be applied in some other cases. I know that in Riga, our German friends with IGRIS have tried also and have had some measurements, but there it seemed that the sodium has lots of impurities after a while and that they lose the signal very quickly. That's also something which happens.
Just a comment about that. We attempted to use the ultrasound on the water version of the Madison experiment, and the turbulent fluctuation levels are so large that it was continuously aliasing into regions, and so with the large amount of turbulence, it was very difficult to use the technique that's being used here.
I have a question about the turbulence and your Reynolds number. First, on which velocity is defined the Reynolds number?
So usually what we take is the dimension, the radius of the sphere for the dimension, and the tangential velocity at the inner sphere. Since we've seen that in our cases, the velocity of the fluid is typically even larger than that, because the angular velocity is even larger. So it's typically what we take. It's, of course, not a measure of the fluctuation in the experiment, obviously, since it's so small.
And then about the fluctuation, you know, if you put rotation, the belief is that it keeps fluctuation, but only in the plane perpendicular to rotation. And I believe it may be the same with magnetic field. So
yeah.
When you say it kills fluctuation, it kills in all three directions, or there are some preferred direction where it is killed?
Well, yeah, you're right. When there is global rotation, we know that fluctuations along the axis of rotation are kind of killed. And similar things happen for the magnetic field, basically. And here, the geometries of the two are not identical. We have axial symmetries for the rotation, but a dipolar field which has this different geometry. And therefore, well, there was this prediction by Meltis and Braginski, it's been mentioned yesterday or the day before, that the turbulence would take the shape of some kind of pancakes. I must say, I'm not sure, I don't know how they would look like in our velocity measurements, these pancakes, but our impression is that it's not really the way turbulence get organized in this case. But I need to better understand maybe what they are.
Maybe we could also have questions for the other two speakers, if there are any outstanding questions. Maybe we should, yeah, go ahead.
So my question is about VKS.
Oh, there you are.
We were speaking a minute ago about suppression of turbulence by rotation or magnetic fields, etc. VKS seems to show suppression of turbulence in that there are these limit cycles and bifurcations that look low dimensional, but there's no global rotation, at least not in a direct way, and there's no imposed magnetic field. So I'd like to hear your thoughts about what might be suppressing the turbulence.
I'm not sure that turbulence is suppressed in the experiment. We didn't perform, as Carrie told you, it's very difficult to perform velocity measurements in this experiment because of the high rate of the high level of turbulence. So I don't know if turbulence is suppressed. Maybe not. It should be suppressed because of the fluctuation should be damped by the magnetic field. We see that in the simulation with Berengère in the Taylor-Green simulations, but in the experiments I don't know.
But would these low-dimensional bifurcation bits work when the Reynolds number is 10 to the 6?
Yeah. 10 to the 7, yes. That's a question. The question is that maybe as the magnetic field is a large-scale magnetic field, and it evolves very slowly compared to the scales of turbulence, to the fast scale of turbulence. Maybe this is why. Maybe there are turbulent fluctuations, but the large-scale magnetic field is behaving like a low-dimensional system. I don't know. It could be an answer. But we have to measure this turbulent fluctuation when the dynamo field is present to answer.
The thing is that it may kill fluctuation, but only large-scale fluctuation. You know, to get a sort of low-dimensional dynamics like this, you need to kill the large-scale fluctuations, the ones that are very efficient to shift everything around. If you don't have large-scale fluctuation and a lot of small-scale, it won't do anything to global organization. So maybe this is what happens.
Good. Maybe what we should do... Are there any more questions? Any more points to be made? Yeah, I suppose what we should do is we should stop now. Why don't we come back at 10 after? And hopefully there will be coffee sometime between now and then.